Welcome to the Speaking Podcast. You can find all our episodes on speakingpodcast.com. We're also on BitChute and YouTube. You find the links in the podcast description. I've also got four other podcasts, along with podcast coaching. You'll find everything on buyer.link/podcaster. Today, my guest, he's also a podcaster. He's a VP of sales. He's a speaker, twice author. Please welcome Kurt Tufert. Did I do it justice?
That's perfect, Roy. Thank you very much. And I am super excited to be on your podcast. I think I'm sitting and listening to a master. So I'm just going to be humble and do the best I can to exceed your expectations.
Well, I'm looking forward to this conversation because I know that the company that you're the VP of sales, I believe it's like 1.5 billion, which is massive. There's very few companies that actually reach that level.
You know, it took us a long time to get there. And now that we're there, we want to go further, right? It's kind of like the American culture that you're always growing. And we're driven as sales professionals to continue to grow. And yes, you know, it's a beautiful number. It's a big number. It's a big company and it takes a lot of messaging to move things around here. As you can imagine, having about 2,700 employees.
Well, so I suppose before we start off, you might just let the listeners know, who's Kurt?
Yeah, sure. So Kurt Tufert, I am the VP of Sales Development for a company called DXP, which is an industrial distributor here in the States in Houston, Texas. We started in 1908, and we sell parts and pieces and consulting services to large industries like energy, food and beverage, things like that. Also a professional speaker, love speaking. Before I came to DXP, had my own business and continue to speak today. I'm a teacher. I'm a professor at the University of Houston where I teach sales and marketing. And an author, as Roy said, a couple of books, podcast host. We have about over 200 outside salespeople and about 250 inside. So there's a net audience of about 500 that I try to create podcasts that allow people to get very good information in small bites so that they can get it, digest it, and apply it.
Excellent. So I suppose prior to you loving speaking, what was your speaking journey?
Oh, it all started when I was in college and I heard a speaker at a fundraising event and his name is John Neighbor, who is a 7-time Olympic gold medal swimmer. And he absolutely captivated me. In fact, as soon as he was done speaking, I rushed the stage, shook his hand and said, I want to be just like you. And he smiled and he was gracious. And he says, I have 7 Olympic gold medals. What do you have? And I'm 22 years old. I'm in college. I have nothing. And he said, I also have a degree in speech communication. So I decided, as I was in my computer science major, very technical major, that I would switch immediately, abruptly, and go right into speech communication. So I got 2 degrees, and then I started to speak at high schools. Is there life after high school? Because I was in college. And then once I graduated college, I'd speak to collegians. Is there life after college? And I spent most of my 20s just trying as hard as I could to speak anywhere for free. And then as I got into my 30s, I started to believe, hey, maybe I have something that people would value because now I'm not 20 anymore. And I started to join the National Speakers Association and I found a mentor and I continued to do the speaking for free until I could get to speak for fee. And I began speaking for a fee, started finding my niche and said, I need to own a certain niche and get really good at being 3 feet wide and 1 mile deep. And that's what caused me to get that momentum going. And of course, I would speak anywhere on almost any topic for almost any fee just to get out there. And it's like if you follow the rock band Bon Jovi, when they first started, it was 3 a.m. sets in the street until they earned the right to go inside the bar, until they earned the right to actually perform when there were people that were not drunk. They just continued to play their music until somebody heard them. And for the people here on this podcast who are speakers or wannabe speakers, or maybe they've just lost their magic, we as speakers, we have got to speak. There's something inside of us that we need to share, as long as it's relevant and that we can find an audience, they will find us.
Fantastic. And I think that was probably the best, you know, decision of your life, actually, to do that, because I was very late to the game. I was mid-40s when I kind of got comfortable and started working on public speaking. But I mean, at 22 is a brilliant age to actually realize that.
Well, think about that. If you roll back the clock, you had people like Zig Ziglar, Brian Tracy, Tony Robbins. These are rock stars in the speaking business who go out to these mega stadiums. And then you've got these niche players, people who talk about time management, health, work-life balance. And there is a place for everyone, as long as your message is attractive to an audience who needs to hear that. And now you are the master, Roy, as you are carving out various podcast niches, which allows us to be speakers on a microphone rather than speakers on a podium. Value is still there. Content is still there. But we as speakers, we have to perfect our craft more, because we might not get that face-to-face audience. We might get that microphone-to-ear audience.
Brilliant, brilliant. So you mentioned podcasters, so it's kind of different to what I'm doing. It's more in-house. So you might let me know how long it started and what you've kind of learned, because I know through my own journey, you know, you're just constantly improving and you're picking up tips, and you go back and look at the first, listen to the first few episodes, and you just cringe.
I cringe even today, Roy, because I don't have really cool bumper music. Now, I know that doesn't mean anything, but it means everything. I don't have this really cool, pithy introduction. However, what I'm learning is I think it's humility. Humility is not thinking less of yourself. It's thinking of yourself less. So I'm humble when I come to my podcast to realize I'm not at a place where I'm going to get 10,000, 15,000 likes or hits. In the States, here in America, I'm not Joe Rogan, and I'm not going to have that giant tribe. I do have a small group of people that are captive within a company, and I get the opportunity to be on other podcasts like yours to share that message. And so I've learned you got to get out there, and you've got to be humble, and then you've got to constantly improve. Listen to other podcasts, listen to their delivery, frame their questions, do the research, and then present things in bite-sized chunks, because you're only capturing whatever is going through their ears most of the time. And that's just one of three learning modalities: visual, audio, and kinesthetic. So I can't see them, I can't touch them, so all I can do is hear them.
Brilliant. And kind of success leaves clues, and obviously you're sharing gold with the people that are, you know, in the company or representatives of the company, but I'm sure that there's plenty that don't listen to it as well. And I'm assuming the ones that are the top 5% probably are the ones that are listening to every single episode.
It's always something that's to think about when you're talking to the top 10% or 5% of any performer: sales, marketing, accounting, business, sports. They're constantly looking for ways to improve, and they're humble enough to say, I'll listen to that coach. He coached another good person. Maybe I can pick something up. And I see that in the sales classes that I teach. The ones who are already successful are the ones who are asking me questions, challenging my content. The ones at the 20% are the worst, or the ones who are struggling. They come to the class with their arms crossed, their mind closed, and defensive and fearful that I might expose them. So you're absolutely right, is the people at the top are constantly looking at, maybe I can learn something from this person. And you nailed it. Success leaves clues. And the first time I heard that phrase was a four-time Olympian loser, someone in the Olympics who were in the Winter Olympics, and the sport is lugeing, Ruben Gonzalez here out of the States. And he said that, and it just floored me, because I thought, if that's true, if success leaves clues, then I need to hang out with people who are successful.
Brilliant. So I know that you're obviously motivating the different salespeople, and they might have teams themselves, but who motivates the motivator? Because not always, I mean, I know myself, I've been involved in a lot of different things. Sometimes you lose your mojo. Sometimes, you know, it's great when you're, but there's times, and I'm just wondering how you deal with a situation like that.
That's a great question. For salespeople, for any kind of people, especially speakers who do things in the motivational side, who motivates the motivator? I have a group of guys that I hang around with who are also speakers, and we hold each other accountable. We can have a cup of coffee at a restaurant and we can say, hey, what's going on here? This is working. That's not working. And I do that. I do a lot of self-motivating where I start listening to other speakers. Maybe I'll go to TED Talks or I'll watch a TED Talk on the internet and I'll pick up on delivery. I'll pick up on content. I'll pick up on the things that they do. And that's what I typically do. And there are areas and days where it's dark as night. I can't close a door, much less a sale. I feel like a coward. I feel like a fraud. You just can't live in that. You can, Tony Robbins and others would say, own it for 30 seconds and then move on. Don't carry it. Don't remind yourself of it. Fine. You want to get a pity party? Have a 30-second pity party. Get out there. If it's a 40-minute pity party, if it's a 6-week pity party, it's too long.
Excellent. Some people, they're trying to build their company and trying to bring in the right salespeople. And there's times, some people, it looks good on paper, but obviously you're working with a massive company, you're in the top position, and you know how to kind of find the right salespeople. So you might give some tips for people that are trying to find the right people that can help them grow.
Roy, I thank you so much for that question, because in 2023, finding good people is very, very difficult. And so we use not only our experience on looking at salespeople, we use assessments. We use a third-party team of assessments where that looks at their behavior, that looks at their selling skills, their selling common sense. And that helps us. That's about a 42% to 45% of the hiring decision is what they said on their assessment.
Like a Briggs-Meyer kind of thing, is it? A kind of Briggs,
It's we have something, and I love it. It's called the sales IQ, or the sales intelligence quotient, and it's beautiful. I use it, and we benchmark. And what that means is we look at a sales position, whether it's an outside sales or an inside sales, and we assess the job. If the job could talk, what would the job say? And then we create this benchmark match it up with the benchmark. Do they have what it takes for this particular job, for this particular culture and company? They may be a pharmaceutical rep, outstanding. They may be a used car salesman, super successful. But just because they're successful in their niches doesn't necessarily mean they'll make it in ours. And so we're professional about looking at that. And the flip side is when we hire a young salesperson, a college or non-college person, we look for what one of our sales vice presidents, Chris Vedrine, he calls a motor. Does he have a motor? And what he means by that, does he have the potential? Does he come in early and stay late, from a sales analogy and from a sports analogy? Is he excited to be on the field? I played a lot of baseball in high school. When it's time to change innings in baseball, do they run to their position or do they kind of stroll out there? It's the motor. And I can take a person who's got a good motor, a good attitude, an open mind, who's humble, who wants to learn. We can teach them the sales skill suite to have them be successful. So yeah, we use assessments and we use an interviewing technique and we try to use it from logic and not emotion.
Brilliant. And when, like, when you've got somebody that you know they're decent, but there's something happening, and you see, you know, there's a big drop off, because I found at times there was times I was kind of doing construction projects in Ireland, and I could have 200 people, but not directly. I had a foreman and engineers and stuff like that on the whole project. But I felt at times you're like an agony ant, making sure you're kind of picking people up, and then everything drives forward. What's the best way to deal with situations? Like, because not everybody is kind of, you know, great at home or whatever. Does whether it's a debt or whether they just, you know, a relationship problem or some, there's always something going on with people.
You bet. Wow. That's, you must be reading my mind, because we have that happening right now. So there's a couple of things, especially when we're thinking about something as simple and as complex as sales. Sales has what we call a quota. You have a certain number that you're required to hit. Now, if you're not hitting that number and you've got something going on in your personal life or in your professional life, my advice to sales managers is come alongside them as a coach or a mentor, try to determine what it is. And if you can help, great. If you can't help, then you've got to give them the chance to either get that improvement up, or because it's a business, they might have to do something else. It's the ugly side of what we do, because we're managing a profit business. And since it's a profit business, we expect our salespeople to generate money. And if they're having a slump because of COVID or post-COVID, or the landscape has changed and all your people are working from home, I'm looking for the person who's making the effort and who's coachable. If they're sitting at home and they're victimizing and saying, everything's wrong, nobody's buying anymore, I need to get into their head and to find out, okay, what's really going on? If it's a death in the family, if it's a loss in a relationship, a separation, a divorce, if it's a tragic career midlife crisis, we try to manage. But there's an ugly cliche that says, we carry our wounded and we shoot our stragglers. And all that ugly cliche means is, look, if you're hurting and you're making an effort, you're on my team. If you're hurting and you're not making an effort, we might have to part ways, because it's a business. And since we are a $1.5 billion publicly traded business, we are beholden to the shareholders, and I'm beholden to a boss who's beholden to a boss. And it's about money. And it's about generating sales. But if you're trying and you're hurting, we'll keep you. But if you're not trying and you're hurting, it's time up for us to part ways. And I'm so sorry that you're having these struggles. And that's just business.
Okay,
it's ugly. I'm sorry I had to come across that way, but it's the truth.
That's perfect. Yeah. And you mentioned quota, because, like, just for me, but I've seen this a few times just by talking to different people. When I was working in construction, I had a system where I was getting like 5% of above planned profit, and if I renegotiated that, it'd be a lot more. But at the time, I was young, and you know, in one project, I made over $1 million above on the project, so I got a very good. And the next time, it should have been the same, because I done very well on another project, and they moved the goalpost and said, oh no, it's like, I know that goes on a lot, and I just moving the goalpost, because I think you're actually hurting the whole organization. But it's something that seems to be common.
It's a brilliant observation, Roy. Yes. In a sales game, in a sales culture, or in a compensation, the more defined the compensation is, the less you can move the goalposts. If you've promised a salesperson an unlimited amount of income and he hits it out of the park, he hits a home run that you would have never thought, that person should get paid everything, because that's the way the plan is. If the management is afraid that the salespeople are making too much money, or egotistically they're making more money than the management team, then yeah, we're going to renegotiate. We're going to move the goalposts. We're going to take some some liberties around your compensation, that kills enthusiasm. That kills the motor, and you'll lose some people. And I've seen it. It's tragic. And I think we're all pretty adult. And if we create a comp plan that has a chance for the runaway train, for the guy who, okay, let's just say he does basically $1 million a year. And that's typical. That's a good year. But all of a sudden, he catches a $4 million deal. We need to pay him on that. And if the next deal, the year after that, he does $700,000 because he has a bad year, because COVID comes, because we lock down, whatever. It's an ebb and flow. And it's so tragic that we in sales management have to move the goalposts. It's a short-term fix, but it's not a long-term solution. We'll lose the momentum of our sales teams.
Yeah. And I heard you talking about drip feed marketing as well, because like they're all kind of related, and especially for, let's say, speakers or coaches, but some entrepreneurs as well. And the marketing side, and also drip feed. You might explain what drip feed is and what your kind of thoughts about the best way of marketing.
Oh, thanks. Thank you very much. I'm very passionate about marketing as it relates to speakers. And here we are, we're talking about speakers, and here we're solopreneurs. We're entrepreneurs. We're just a small band of people, and we don't have budgets and giant staff. Drip marketing is our ability in speaking to be able to be top of mind with our prospects and our clients, using a series of automations. For instance, I use a product called Mailbox Power, and I can automate a drip marketing campaign where someone will get a recipe on a postcard from me every month for 12 months. All I need is your name, address, city, state, and zip. It automatically drips out. Maybe it's an automatic email dripping campaign where I've got the five secrets to sales success. And I drip one out, and then 2 weeks later comes number two, 2 weeks later comes number three. The point is, drip marketing in an automated world of 2023 with all of our technology allows us to reach more people on a cadence. And so those people, when they think about making a decision, they'll think about the person who has given them the postcard, has given them the card, has given them the email, has given them the information. And that's what I use for drip marketing.
Brilliant. And like when you're doing your own kind of social media or getting your own list is grand, but, and this is kind of big for America. And I know that there's like 50% of my listeners are based in America. Some people actually go away and buy lists. When you're doing that, are you better off just getting like a little percentage of it? Because sometimes that list is sold to thousands of people and people just don't subscribe, or they don't even live in the places. Like, do you do tests, and what's your thoughts on actually buying a list?
Well, so, you know, it's a shameless marketing plug, Roy. With the product I use, Mailbox Power, we do have a listing feature, and I use that listing feature, and it works a lot of the times. I would call it about an 87% hit rate. I'm looking for people who are business owners or sales vice presidents or the human resource person within X kind of a geography, Y kind of a number of employees. So I have a higher probability of going after the people I want. I take that list. I try a little bit of postcard marketing because it's the cheapest way of validating their physical address. Email marketing, I can check with my Constant Contact or my MailChimp. Am I getting an open rate? If I send it out to 1,000 people and I get a 20% open, that's pretty good. That's 200 people open my email. I know who they are because the software tells me, and I can take that sub list and I can do some additional marketing. I think lists are okay. I think we still have to go out there and do our value add networking, maybe some business development, maybe doing some referral based marketing. And it's not overnight. Even if we are the best speaker out there and we have the best message on a subject that everybody wants, it still requires us to market, collect names, go out there, ask for the decision maker who hires speakers, put them in our drip marketing campaign, treat them with respect, treat them with professional courtesy. And over time, that will prevail because you're touching them. Some of the latest statistics say that we need to touch someone up to 15 times before they actually will want to take our call or remember who we are, because there's so much marketing out there. There's so much noise. And so we've got to be patient and we've got to pick that lane, and it's got to be so, so powerful and so compelling that people will want to listen to our very quick 30-second commercial.
Excellent. And I just know with the different things that I've done, I was never aggressive, as in ringing somebody every day, or just I'd kind of either once a week or once a month. And unless they said, don't ring me. And I found that sometimes you can be like 2 years down the line and you get the sale. But there's a lot of people, they feel like they're infringing on someone's space by even going two or three times. And like, how would you get that message out to people to kind of realize you kind of need to be doing that? I mean, you touched there 15 points, and I've seen that. Like, it definitely is. It's not two or three hits.
You know, everyone has, not everyone, let's just say we're a speaker and we have a subject that people are interested in, and we can take that subject and break that down into the top 5 points of your keynote or your half day training. If you drip on that person through a card or an email, point one, point two, point three, point four, point five, you're adding value. You are giving away some of your value content in a small bite to that person. Are you intruding on them? No, you're adding value. Are they receiving that value? Probably later on, as you continue to ring them or connect with them through another type of email, they might say, yeah, you're the guy that sends me that information. I've used it. It's of value. Tell me more. And even me as a receiver, I get a lot of people who send me things. If I see something that's consistent and they're really interested in the value, I'll pick up. Social media, you mentioned social media. I had the opportunity to do a little bit of research on you before the call so that I could create a little bit of trust and rapport and be fascinated by who you are just from your veneer of your social media. And then I want to drill down into that. We as speakers, when we're looking for people who hire speakers, probably they're on social media. Maybe they're on LinkedIn. Maybe we can get some additional information and craft a message in a very unique way that adds value. We got to add value as speakers. And it's not the way I define value. It's the way the people who are receiving me defines value. Once we lock that in, we can actually market with absolute honesty and passion, because we're not intruding on them. We're adding value.
Brilliant. And I suppose a hard audience is students. So you've been teaching students for a long time, I'm assuming, on sales and what we're kind of discussing, sales marketing. What have you learned over the years that has actually made you connect better with them? Because obviously we learn constantly as we go along.
Boy, it's... Tomorrow, I'll be at Texas A&M University here in Texas, and I'm teaching 4 classes. So every one of those students are somewhere between 22 and 26. And that's 40 years old. I'm 40 years older than them in some cases. What could I possibly give them besides the respect and the authority of an older person? I try to get relevant, and I try to use a little bit of humor as we talk about sales, as we talk about the profession of selling. Or for instance, tomorrow I'll be using the assessment called DISC, and I'll be talking about behavioral styles, how to connect with another person based on their behavioral style. It's fun. It's got a lot of relevant messaging from our current culture. And I sometimes can break the barrier of, oh gosh, this guy's as old as my grandfather. What is he going to teach me? And I just come across as a little bit younger, because of course, when you're teaching college students, they never age. Every student is between 22 and 26. They never age. We age, they don't. And so I just kind of use some of that to my advantage.
And like, I mean, we see the social media problem, people addicted to devices. Do you just let it be, or is it something that you put? Because that happens at events as well. Like, and especially people that are holding up their phones at events is kind of annoying if you're trying to actually pay attention. But it, with students especially, like, if they're glued to their phones, is it, do you just say that's their loss for not paying attention, or do you kind of set ground rules?
I tried at first to set ground rules before there were phones, there were laptops. And when I started teaching at the master's level, the students got older, but they also came to class with their laptops open because they were allegedly taking notes on it. I am not the professor that demands full attention. Turn off your phone, turn off your laptop. I teach to the content, and if I'm valuable, they'll listen to me, but I can't get every single one of them. And you know, it's the same tragic nature in other social outfits like church. If you're at the front, all you see is a bunch of people looking down on their phones because their favorite game is on. And so they're catching the highlights of the game. They're not listening to the content. It's a new normal, which I'm not necessarily happy about, but I'm just as much a violator. Yeah. So I think we just got to park our ego at the door and just let them do what they do.
And you just mentioned the church there. So I know that you're doing kind of summer missions to Honduras. You might tell me a bit about that.
Sure. So that started about 7-8 years ago. I was in a very dark place. A relationship was unwinding. And a friend of mine said I needed to volunteer for everything. And so I volunteered and I found myself with nothing. I don't have medical skills. I just felt I didn't have any skills to go on a trip. And so the leader said, well, why don't you just carry my tool bag? And that sounded very demeaning, but I understood his point. So I show up and he teaches me how to build a swing set. And then the next year I was building the swing sets. And then over the course of about 5 more years, I led a team. So last year I actually led the team right out of COVID. We hadn't gone in a couple of years, I would help build swing sets for the kids down there. There'd be a medical side, there'd be a dental side, there'd be an educational side. And it's always this, I always just pick the same place, Honduras. And it was wonderful. And the country is struggling, but the people are happy. And every time I go, I just am amazed that you have nothing. You don't even have electricity and you're happy, and you'd be more than willing to make me a meal or invite me into your home and have a conversation. And so I get to give back, and it's really a wonderful feeling to have the chance to give back.
And kind of, you mentioned you were struggling at the time. I mean, I don't think people realize that when you're actually helping somebody else and going there on a mission and doing different, it is actually you're benefiting, because by providing a service to people that you know wouldn't otherwise get it, it's you get the feel good factor, and it just changes your mindset and you come back a different person.
You absolutely do, because it's a family trip. So I bring a lot of teenagers, and once they see what these people don't have, they come back a little bit more thankful for the car they have and the meals that they get and the clothes on their back. You know, in Honduras, you have to pay for your uniform to go to school. If you can't pay for the uniform, your kids don't go to school. And that's just it. And we saw many kids on the opposite side of the school. There's a giant fence, and the kids are in school on one side of the fence and kids are not in school. And what do? Well, they work in the fields, they get into drugs, they make babies. And, you know, I met a couple of young boys. They were 16 years old, and they had a 2-year-old son. Now, the reality of that to an American who goes to a private high school, that's a teaching moment. You know, there's a teaching moment there. And yeah, you're right. And I was hurting. I was going through a really rough time. And so I gave back. I poured myself out on the field there in Honduras. I left nothing back. And I actually, my cup was filled from them. They blessed me more than I could ever bless them, and that's why I carried it for 7 more years.
Brilliant. So you mentioned, yeah, the craziness for the last few years, kind of now the virtual world, I know it's kind of returning to normal. Obviously you've experienced that, and now just kind of a bit of hybrid. What have you kind of learned the kind of online speaking, or maybe, I don't know, have you done any hybrid where you didn't have to go to the place to speak?
There's a lot of sales coaching right now on Zoom. It's hybrid. It's a stopgap because a lot of the sales coaching you really can't do on Zoom. You've got to be hands-on with that. I've noticed that people are doing more using technology. For instance, in our business, you know, people going out, the purchasing people are working from home. You can't have a sales call at somebody's home. They're using technology. They're not really caring about the technical side of a purchase. They're just Googling where they can find it cheaper. And then they're just looking at that commodity. So coming back from the pandemic craziness, for us, it's a technical conversation. If it's a commodity, go to Amazon. If it's a commodity, go to your local supermarket and have them deliver the groceries to your car. We can't compete in that game. For us as speakers, we've got to find out, do we have a valuable conversation? Do we have a valuable message, valuable enough that they, the audience, are willing to congregate, to come to see you in a meeting? I see that coming back, not at the same rate it was prior to that. And then again, if your message is good enough to do on a Zoom call, well, there's a whole boutique industry awaiting you. You can charge a fee and you can do that. I've got several speaker friends who do coaching, small group speaking, and it's based on Zoom. And they use the Zoom techniques of breakout rooms and chatting and putting comments in and trying to be a facilitator of their speaking craft in a Zoom environment. And they've made it work because that appears to be the new norm. And with budgets being where they're at, many times I can't send my staff to the conference because that's time away from the office. That's expensive airfare. But I can send them to the conference on a Zoom call. Maybe the price is a little bit less, and I can do it during business hours, and I can offer the recording. So there are value-added ways of using this technology. And if you're used to that platform and you're used to, you know, 200, 300, 400 people, or you're used to a corporation that has these annual meetings, and those meetings have gone away, it's almost like the old book, Who Moved My Cheese? You can't wait for the cheese to come back because it's not going to come back. So reinvent, recraft, retool, package your product in a way that would be appealing in a new normal, which could be Zoom, small group, smaller fee, but more volume.
Brilliant. So, I mean, you mentioned book. I know you've written two. So I think your first one was 201 Sales Motivators or something. You might just tell me a little bit about that one first.
So I laugh because I was young and I thought, you know, back in the day you could get like calendars that were spiral bound and you could get a little motivational quote for 365 days. Well, I didn't have 365 ideas. I had 201, and these were ideas with a little quote and then a little editorial, and you could be a sales guy and you could pick this up and thumb through it and maybe catch something that was exciting and that could change your day. And it was fun, but it was all done on a shoestring, is using the American cliche. I couldn't even afford the shoestring on the shoestring budget. So I still have about four of these left. And, it just reminds me of how hungry I was to provide a product. The second book, Five Stones for Slaying Giants, as a full-time speaker and traveling internationally and doing a lot of speaking, I had a partner. And he and I had a challenge because, you know, we were both type A overachievers. Who was going to create their book first? And I came up with my keynote, Five Stones for Slaying Giants, Passion, Excellence, Vision, Value, and Confidence. And I would keynote that across the United States and create small breakout workshops on those five stones. So I put it into a book. And the book was a small book, self-published. and I would use it for back of the room sales. I would use it as a way to say what differentiates me from your other speaker you might choose is I'm an author and everyone gets a copy of the book. And I would weave in passion, excellence, vision, value, and confidence inside whatever I was talking about. And so I loved it. In fact, I was on a podcast recently, and the podcast host started referencing things from the book. And I went, oh yeah, it's a while ago, man. That was a minute ago that I wrote that book. And so I still use the principles. In fact, here at DXP, there are 5 podcasts that are passion, excellence, vision, value, and confidence. So I absolutely love it. And you can tell that my energy level just kicked in, Roy, because I just love that kind of stuff.
And did you self-publish or did you go with a publisher for that?
I went to a website, instantpublisher.com, and they were gracious enough to take a Microsoft Word document and make it into magic. I did hire an artist to create the cover, and I went to a conference, the National Speakers Association, and one of the breakout sessions was how to write a book in 90 days. And I'm a student of notes. I took so many notes and I followed his plan and I put it all together, sent it out there, a couple of typos. In fact, right behind me in this red is my manuscript that I keep vowing to go with version 2.0 because the analogies are old. You know, I wrote that book back when the world was in a different place. I still believe in speakers, podcast hosts, podcast guests. We have to have passion for what we do. We have to have a level of excellence in how we partake in that passion. We have to have a vision for where we're going. We have to add value and we have to rock that confidence. So I believe it's still relevant today. It would just be a rebranding, which would cause more book sales and it would still be self-published.
Yeah, brilliant. And I mean, with all your experience and obviously, you know, the position that you've got for those that are trying to build a sales team or what, with books like sales and marketing, any recommendations? I mean, sure. I love Dan Kennedy. Russell Branson is another guy who bought Glazer Kennedy. But I just see what they're doing is like, you know, and they're kind of nice guys. You know, the way sometimes you can take to somebody. I just like their style and the different things they're doing. I'm just curious who you'd be kind of recommending people to study.
Yeah, you mentioned guys who will literally just give away all of their secrets. They're so gracious in the way they write and the way that they give away. For sales books, you know, I'm bringing some of our new hires, 7 new college kids. We call them the Magnificent 7, and we're bringing them through a leadership development program. And we've asked them all, as recent as yesterday, to grab a book from Amazon called The Greatest Salesman in the World from Og Mandino. It's a simple, easy book. It talks about 10 scrolls. That's enough for most salespeople to just be reminded about in the scrolls, or it's a great story. That's a wonderful book. It's one of my favorite books out there. So that's the one that I would say, pick up a book. That's a really good book. Use that one to start with. And then of course you can always bleed into the other ones. I believe it was The Gift Giver or The Giver. I forgot the author on that one. They're all more allegorious stories, not so much the 7 process statements in order to close business or any of this academician kind of stuff. That's all out there. That's relevant. But for most of us, sales is still building a relationship, one human being to another. And I'm a big proponent in DISC. So Wilson Learning wrote a book called Social Styles. And in fact, that was prerequisite for my master's level class when I taught business communication. And it's just how to have conversations, how to be curious, and then listen. And then you might have a value proposition that fixes their challenges. And that's all that I think sales is all about, is uncovering their challenges, finding out if they're willing to make a change, and then offering them a solution to their change.
Brilliant, brilliant. And just finally, like the social media mob was curious, which is your kind of go-to social media, especially for yourself, you know, when you've got a lot of different hats on, you know, with the company, as a speaker. I mean, the podcast is kind of more internal, so that wouldn't be an external podcasting thing, but the coaching, just everything that you're doing, like, do you think that you promote yourself and put everything where you are, or do you try to have separate little websites and keep everything as a separate entity?
I think there's value in both. If you were to create microsites for all the things that you're doing, that would catch more audiences. Right now, I've got LinkedIn as a profile, as a presence, and I've got my web developer redeveloping my website. And I'm knocking on wood that it'll be done. I'm hoping, you know, by the end of this month. That's my goal, was to get that done. So it's a relaunch of my peaksalesstrategy.com site and offering my new coaching that I'm doing. I'm doing some sales coaching in a Zoom format because people just don't have the money and the time to go fly people out to these great big sales events. And then, you know, out of that social media, you collect email addresses and addresses and you start building a tribe. I'm real big on thinking, you know, if you can build a tribe of people who follow you and you add value to them, that's a good thing. That leads into speaking opportunities. That leads into people who can refer you to someone else, just like your podcast, just like how I found you, just how your tribe is being built because of your professional coaching and what you've done. Those different podcasts that you have attract different audiences and they continue to grow based on the value you provide. So yeah, I mean, LinkedIn is a way of doing it, and multiple websites would be another way.
Brilliant. Listen, Kurt, thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. You might let people know best way to get you, contact you.
LinkedIn, there's only one Kurt Tufert out there. You know, in the show notes, you've got CURTTUEFFERT. You can find me on LinkedIn. We can have conversations. If you want to know more about some of the products that I use, for instance, Mailbox Power, I'd be more than happy to share that information with anyone. If you're out there and you're saying, hey, I'm stuck, man, help me, Kurt. You can always reach out to me. I've got several email addresses out there on social media. I love being able to pay it forward. And Roy's given me the opportunity to share that. And I want to be able to give back. So, you know, tap into me if you need to. And I'd be more than happy to help.
Brilliant. Thanks very much, Kurt. And I'll make sure I'll put all the links both on the audio and the video.
Thank you very much, Roy.
No problem. So that's all for the Speaking Podcast. You'll find all our episodes on speakingpodcast.com. As mentioned, we're on BitChute YouTube. You'll find my other podcasts along with the coaching bio.link/podcaster. Be sure to give us a thumbs up, 5-star rating, and share with your friends. I'd ask to give Kurt a 5-star rating on his podcast, but it's an internal one, so we can't do that. But you can perhaps check out his book. Until next week, take care.